My guest tonight is Dr. E. Michael Jones. He has generously decided to return to the show to discuss, well, to discuss America First, because it has been invoked by the presumptive GOP nominee, Donald Trump, when he was criticized for invoking the name America First in one of his speeches, I think, in April. And he's also written a couple of excellent pieces for Culture Wars magazine, Donald Trump and the Failed Casino, which I think is in the June edition, and Phyllis Schlafly Takes on the Oligarchs, which I think was in the April edition. Both discuss the issue of, grassroots, the people versus the oligarchs, and the same problem, the problems that we're confronted with today politically. But first, I want to talk about America First. And America First, of course, was the anti-war, I guess, non-interventionist, maybe isolationist, as some would say, Midwestern movement back in the 1940-41. It garnered about support about 900,000 paying dues members, and it opposed the Roosevelt administration's drive to war in the 1940-41 period. Dr. Jones, how are you doing tonight?
Good, good.
America First. Donald Trump used that term recently, and I ran across a piece in CNN, doc, written by, I can find that piece here, by Susan Dunn, who is a professor of humanities at Williams College. And she's the author of 1940, FDR, Wilkie, Lindbergh, Hitler, The Election Amid the Storm. And she opened her piece saying, she opens the piece with Donald Trump's statement, which is, "My foreign policy will always put the interest of the American people and American security above all else. That will be the foundation of every decision that I will make. America First will be the major and overriding theme of my administration." And then she writes, "It's extremely unfortunate that in his speech Wednesday outlining his foreign policy goals, Donald Trump chose to brand his foreign policy with the noxious slogan, America First, the name of the isolationist, defeatist, anti-Semitic national organization that urged the United States to appease Adolf Hitler." Okay, so that's her description of America First. How would you describe America First?
Well, we had a battle that began after World War I. The American people were radically opposed, or let's put it this way, they got tricked into World War I, and then they got stuck with the bill afterwards, and a wave of what you would call isolationism swept through the country. It manifested first by an anti-immigrant feeling, a very restrictive immigration policy that went into effect in the mid-1920s. And then the situation got worse after the stock market crash of 1929. And so what you began to see was a full-blown rejection of financial internationalism, symbolized by Wall Street. And at this point, the antithesis of Wall Street was the Midwest. You could call it Main Street. And this was the area of the country that had been grown strong because of manufacturing. It had grown up because of the system of protected manufacturers and tariffs that had been erected in the 19th century. And it was the most powerful industrial machine in the world at that time, crippled by bad finance. And so this too began in around 1913 with the beginning of the Fed, when the government got into high finance. J.P. Morgan had died. There was no more banker of last resort. The government had to step in. And what they realized at that point was that 90%, I think the figure was like 90% of all the businesses in the Midwest financed their operations, expansions, capital expansion through profit. And so at this point, Wall Street and the financiers are excluded from a huge market. And so over this period of time, they try to insinuate themselves. They want to lend money to these people. They want to get control through debt. And the whole thing blows up in their face with 1929. And by the 1930s, you have a large-scale reaction against capitalism and international finance. And these people are not going to take it lying down. And so for the 1930s, you have a battle. The Catholic angle was best summarized by this encyclical Quadragesimo Anno, which came out in 1934, which basically was an attack on communism, but saw capitalism as the parent. Basically, this is what caused communism. Capitalism has failed. Now we have to deal with communism and the communist reaction. And you have this nationalist, this exaggerated nationalism in places like Italy, Germany, and to a certain extent in Spain, in reaction to this international, this Jewish international financial and revolutionary movement. And so it became clear by the 1930s that, as Lindbergh said, there are three groups that want to get us into the war. He gave the speech in Des Moines, Iowa, and in St. Louis. I mentioned the St. Louis one in 1937, and he said the three groups were the English, the Roosevelt administration, and the Jews. Now, Charles Lindbergh was a certified American hero. He had flown a plane called the Spirit of St. Louis across the Atlantic Ocean. He was idolized by Henry Ford. This was a group of people who felt that a lot of them were of German heritage, didn't want to get into a war, didn't like the idea of war, felt that it was antithetical to everything that they believed in, the America stood for. And they found themselves up against the international financiers who had money invested in foreign markets. And if there were no war, they were going to lose their shirts. And so that's what the battle began that way. The English needed American support, so they sent the English agent Intrepid over. His name is Stevenson, I believe. He got a whole floor of the Rockefeller Center in New York to basically get America into the war. And, of course, that's exactly what happened with Pearl Harbor. We know now that Pearl Harbor, that Roosevelt knew in advance about the attack. They had cracked the code, and he basically allowed over 2,000 Americans to die to create the shock wave that would propel America into the war. At that point, America First was over. Lindbergh tried to volunteer, but he was persona non grata because you're not allowed to criticize these groups. That was the end of America First. I personally knew Henry Regnery, the publisher, conservative publisher. His father had the list. The FBI came and took the list away from him. So those 900,000 contributors were gone now. Now, we all know that victors write the history. And so what has happened since that time is books like the one you just quoted. In other words, everything bad about America can be summed up by the two words, America First, because they said so. And even another recent example of this kind of undying Jewish animus against this was Philip Roth's book, The Plot Against America, a great example of Jewish paranoia. I mean, Philip Roth is on top of the world. He's been on top of the fictional world since 1969. And here he is kind of fearing the ghost of Charles Lindbergh and all of these people. Father Coughlin, for example, is completely demonized by these people because why? Because they lost. They lost the war. But what does that mean? What lost? What lost was the Midwest. What does that mean? That means no foreign entanglements. It means protected manufacturers. It means high wages. All of these things were gone. All of these things were destroyed. And once the oligarchs got their hands on the levers of power, they completed, it was just one thing after another. So obviously, when 1941, there is no interest in the federal government to destroy the manufacturing base of the United States. This has to become the arsenal for democracy. We need that Ford plant in Willow Run to make bombers instead of trucks. And so it's all been repurposed, reconfigured, and it starts churning out weapons to win the war. After the war, we had a period of prosperity and amelioration, that continued from the New Deal, when Roosevelt had to save the regime from socialism or communism. We had the crucial moment came in 47. Henry Ford died. His grandson took over, Henry II, and sat down and actually dealt with the UAW. And so at this point, we had high wages. High wages allowed people to raise families, raise children. It brought about broad-based prosperity in the United States of a sort that is now a distant memory to people of my generation, the baby boom generation. They remember their fathers coming home at 5:30 for dinner, going out and playing baseball after dinner. All this stuff is gone. All this stuff is gone. And in its place, we now have the gay disco. The gay disco, which is the symbol of America. I'm not making this up. This is Frank Bruni in the New York Times. He's a homosexual. The whole murder in Atlanta. In Orlando, the disco murder. All of the New York Times pundits now who are completely internationalists, have always been internationalist in their orientation, are now talking about America. What does America stand for? America is the gay disco. And love it or leave it. And if you don't support the gay disco, you're not an American. This shows you how far we have come from the days when real issues were on the table, namely from the 1930s and then in the 1950s. So in the interim, what you saw, the crucial turning point was the late 70s, from 75 up until 79, when basically the oligarchs, the people who control the Western world, turned on what they called Fordism, which is what I just described, another word for America First, at least a facet of America First, and decided that they were going to abolish the industrial infrastructure of the Western world. They were going to put it on the block. And this happened beginning with the Reagan administration. Paul Volcker became head of the Fed. He immediately raised interest rates and killed the economy. It was like chemotherapy for the economy. We're going to kill the economy because we want to drive down wages. And for the past almost 40 years now, we've had this atrocious anti-labor, internationalist, sexual liberationist regime that is the antithesis of everything that America stood for. So something this radical, so basically what happened at this point was that, okay, England and America put them on the auction block, put those factories on the auction block. So we have cheap credit because we got the Fed pumping out money and you've got access to the money. So you buy up these companies, you load them down with debt, and then they go belly up because it doesn't matter anymore because all the manufacturing is going to be done in China, in low-wage areas of the world. And so you have the era of internationalism on steroids, internationalism with a vengeance, and something this radical cannot go on uncontested. It's impossible. And so what we're seeing now, both with Brexit and the Trump campaign, is the return of the repressed. Trump, I've said this before, he's like the broken clock. He's right twice a day. And he's right with America First. I was at the Trump rally in South Bend, Indiana, and said later that the important thing was the 5,000 people on the other side of the stage, not the one guy with the blonde hair up on the front. That is a wave, that represents a wave of discontent. This is an uprising against the oligarchs. The New York Times agrees with me, so it must be true. Roger Cohen said it was an uprising against what he called the smug elites. That's exactly what it is. The smug elites in the United States and the smug elites in Europe, known as the European Union, all those unelected bureaucrats who are running the lives and ruining the lives of large numbers, especially the working class people in places like England. which is a shell of the manufacturing power that it used to be, largely because of all this predatory finance. So that's where we stand now. The Jews do not like the term America First. It is the antithesis of everything the Jews, with their international banking connections and Goldman Sachs and promotion of homosexual marriage. It's the antithesis of everything they don't like. It's the antithesis of everything they stand for. And that's why the ADL immediately issued a warning to Donald Trump when he used the term America First. You're not allowed to do this. You know, if you keep it up, we'll demon it. We'll call you an anti-Semite, which is precisely what this lady here said. The professors are all stooges of the oligarchs. That's what you're there for when you're a professor. And so they write these fawning books and they take up these things and basically demonize the people that the oligarchs want demonized. So that's where we stand today.
It's their 30 pieces of silver, so to speak, right?
Well, I don't think they get that much anymore.
they don't get precious metal, right?
Adjuncts get next to nothing. So you really it's a bad situation for if you're licking the boots, you got a lot of licking to do and not much return, not much payback for your effort. That's the situation we're in now.
But in your article, you do point out the fact that at one time there was something called the Midwest that had its own values and perhaps interests separate that of Wall Street and Washington and the city of London. It's interesting that Professor Dunn, she accuses America First of appeasing Hitler, but no one ever talks about appeasing London and the British Empire.
Oh, because you're appeasing the right people there.
Yeah.
And secondly, no one was appeasing Hitler.
No.
This is ridiculous.
Bad history.
This is ridiculous.
History.
Why did you say that? Yeah. Why did you say that? Where did that come from?
Yeah.
Is that the gist of Father Coughlin's Kristallnacht speech? No, and he's demonizing an anti-Semite, and he said basically he condemned Hitler for his racial politics. This is not what we believed in. I mean, certainly we Catholics never believed in this type of racism, never believed in it. This is not what was going on. He said basically, okay, the Jews then were complaining about the Catholics, saying that they're still talking about Hitler as the Catholic, Pope Pius XII, Hitler's Pope. All this type of calumny is just perfectly acceptable discourse. And he said back then, he said, look, if you're going to say that Catholics are responsible for Hitler, well, what about the Jewish responsibility for Bolshevism? Well, that's another thing you're not allowed to talk about, you know. Don't talk about that, because everybody knows it's true, but I mean, nobody's allowed to say it. So what you have here is the return of the repressed. Think of Indiana 4 years ago. Indiana 4 years ago voted for Mitt Romney. I mean, if there's ever an oligarch, ever a looter.
Bain Capital, yeah.
I mean, Bain Capital came. There's the one good thing that Newt Gingrich did in his political career was put out that video called "When Mitt Romney Comes to Town." It was absolutely devastating, and it talked about Indiana, how Mitt Romney would come in, Bain Capital comes in, buys up this perfectly good washing machine manufacturing company in Indiana, loads it down with debt, steals the money, and then the company goes belly up, and everybody loses their job. So. That was 4 years ago, and they still voted for Mitt Romney. Well, now, when Trump takes the stage, he starts talking about Carrier air conditioning, moving its plant to Mexico, and everybody's screaming. You know, they have 5,000 people in the room. We're all screaming for blood here. He knows what the issues are. He understood that. Well, that shows you the change that has taken place in consciousness in Indiana in this basically short period of time, 4 years. It's gone from Mitt Romney to Donald Trump. It's gone from voting for a guy who worked for Bain Capital as a looter to now the guy who's complaining about Carrier air conditioning leaving. So this is a protest vote. The masses have awakened. They now understand the situation much better than they understood it 4 years ago. Mm-hmm. They know that we have basically the situation in England and the situation in the United States are essentially the same. You have two parties that represent the oligarchs and no party that represents the people. And this, in many ways, is the Achilles heel of the American system from their point of view and their greatest fear. Because the whole, from the very beginning, the United States has been created by oligarchs. They were called creditors then, which is the essence of what an oligarch is. Someone who lends money out and then enslaves people by making them pay interest on the money. This usury is what we call it in moral terms. Okay, this country was created by the creditors and for the creditors and of the creditors, and they were immediately involved in a swindle as soon as they got in power. They bought up the bonds, the Revolutionary War bonds from widows of Revolutionary War soldiers for pennies on the dollar, and then they came back and forced the government to pay them full face value in gold. Well, everyone was outraged. This is a swindle. They're outraged as a swindle, and it led to Shay's Rebellion. If you fast forward over 200 years later to 2008, exactly the same thing happened. It's happened again. You know, with the stock market crash, Goldman Sachs is left holding the bag here with all of this bad debt. So what do? They connive with the Obama administration, with Tim Geithner, who then offers up AIG as a sacrificial lamb. Why did they do that? Because AIG was going to take Goldman Sachs to court and say, no, no, you're going to have to prove this. And when you got bondholders, if the thing goes bad, the bondholders take a haircut. That's just standard capitalist procedure. That's what should have happened in 2008. Instead, the Obama administration does the same thing they did at the beginning, the oligarchs did at the beginning. They kill AIG, and then they pay off Goldman Sachs with all their crooked, toxic loans at full face value. This is a scandal, even according to capitalist principles. And that's the situation. I mean, people are awakened now. They have a consciousness that they didn't have 4 years ago, and we're in the middle of an uprising against the oligarchs.
Now, going back to just America first, is Lindbergh is ostracized for calling out the Roosevelt administration, the Brits, and Jewish influence in America for dragging the country into the war, and I guess what he says is true, and he's called an anti-Semitic. You make the point in the article that Jews have claimed with pride that they themselves were instrumental in America's entry into the war, thus proving Lindbergh correct in that assessment, but they can say it. They're not called anti-Semitic because they're Jewish, but Lindbergh says the same thing because that's a common tactic. He's called anti-Semitic for stating the truth.
Right. And so that's exactly the situation we're in right now.
Yeah.
I've mentioned, like, if you say the Jews are behind gay marriage, they will call you an anti-Semite. Of course, Amy Dean said this in an article in Tikkun, and of course she's not called an anti-Semite. Or Joe Biden says the same thing, and he's not called an anti-Semite. So this is an intolerable double standard. And believe me, anti-Semitism, the threat of calling someone an anti-Semite, is the main bulwark that the oligarchs use to beat down any type of criticism of what they do. Mm-hmm. That's the role that the Jews play. And since they control media, they can enforce this with a ruthlessness that sometimes takes my breath away, especially when you look at the contradiction that's involved here, because we're not talking, we're not disagreeing. We're saying the same thing. But why am I an anti-Semite when I agree with you?
Yeah, because they don't want to argue the substance of the policy.
No, they don't. Yeah. It's the same thing with pornography. I've mentioned this before. I wrote a book, an article, which is in the Jewish Revolutionary Spirit on Jews control pornography. Okay. I'm called an anti-Semite. Then Professor Abrams in England, he takes all my material, publishes it in the Jewish Quarterly, and he probably gets a raise because he published the article. So it's exactly the same thing. What do we have to be ashamed of? So why am I called an anti-Semite? What is going on here?
Yeah.
This is intolerable. No wonder we're getting nowhere. But the point here is that even in spite of all this, in spite of the most sophisticated form of psychological warfare, propaganda, and mass media control, the word is still getting out. And Brexit is proof of it. And the Trump campaign is another example of the same thing.
Yeah, it's losing its sting. People aren't.
Yeah. So the problem is that it all has to come down to you have to be able to convince people, and once you come up with a plausible counter explanation, everything collapses. It doesn't work, and actually, it brings about the exact opposite effect, and that hasn't caught on yet. I don't think in the halls of the New York Times, they haven't quite figured that out yet. And the best example I can give is the most recent example is the day before the Orlando attack. New York Times does a puff piece on our homosexual mayor in South Bend, Indiana, Pete Buttigieg. It's done by Frank Bruni. He's a homosexual himself. It's like Pete Buttigieg has a killer resume. I mean, everyone will agree. He should retire his resume and put it in the resume book of fame, you know. But the hidden message, they don't understand that the real message they're conveying is Pete Buttigieg is a stooge of the oligarchs. That's why you're doing this. Mm-hmm. It becomes completely transparent. What is the point of this article in New York Times? Well, to say that this man is pleasing to the people who are oppressing us. And then the article goes on to say, he may seek higher office in Indiana. No, that's never going to happen. He couldn't be elected dog catcher in Kokomo because we know now that he doesn't represent the people of Indiana. That is precisely the crisis that we are facing right now. The oligarchs created a system where they call it democratic capitalism, or Michael Novak wrote a book called The Spirit of Democratic Capitalism and said, they go, it's like bacon and eggs, bread and butter. No, Michael, you got it exactly wrong. They are the opposite. And that's the problem. What you have is a country a constitution that was created to pursue the interest of the oligarchs, namely usury and controlling everybody through financial means. But that has no legitimacy. And a new country like the United States needed legitimacy, and so they have to give the illusion that we are dealing with consent of the governed. Well, once you say that, there are people who take it seriously. There are actually people who think, well, yeah, I do believe that we have. And actually, there are institutions, like there are legislatures in states like Indiana, believe it or not, and they meet in a city called Indianapolis, and they make laws. Well, what we're seeing now is this is outdated. Because if the state of Indiana makes a law which is not pleasing to the oligarchs, you'll have Mark Benioff, the head of Salesforce, parachute into your country, into your state. He's from San Francisco, and he's going to tell you that you can't have that law. I'm the important person. I'm a CEO. I represent the homosexuals. These are the important people. You hicks from Indiana, you have to change the law. That's happened. It happened last year, and now this year, it's North Carolina. Do you rednecks in North Carolina seriously believe that you have the right to tell people there which bathroom they can pee in, or restrict people according to where they can pee? No. This is a right that is reserved to the oligarchs now. And if you don't do what we want, we will wreak economic havoc on your state.
Yeah, there is. The provincials in North Carolina actually think the bathrooms should be segregated based on your biological sex.
Yes, and that shows you how stupid they are, doesn't it? Because what we really need to talk about is how you feel. Do you feel like a man or do you feel like a woman today? Mm-hmm. You know, and if you're a voyeur and you want to go take a shower in the ladies' room, well, then you just tell people that you're in the ladies' locker room. So. So in other words, what is going on here? What we are doing is we are now setting a precedent where a law is based on a completely subjective state of mind with no possibility of verification. How can I tell you what this lunatic is thinking? How can I know what's inside of his mind? How can we base a law on something that subjective? Well, what is the secret? What is the message here? The message is that the law is a tool of the powerful. That democracy is a cruel charade. It's a facade whose only purpose is to ratify the schemes of the oligarchs. That's the only purpose for a popular vote. And if they don't do it, then don't do it right, then we will remind them until they get it right. This is the crisis that we are now facing in this country, and also the crisis that's going to be that has just been unleashed on England because of the Brexit vote, and will pervade all of Europe now. Because the system has been exposed, the hypocrisy of the system has been exposed for everyone to see.
Now, with you in the article on Donald Trump, you pointed out a piece that Paul Krugman wrote. He called it the failed casino, his view of the economy. And you put it well here with this. He says, it was Trump's comment about bankruptcy that led Paul Krugman to claim that he was going to run the country like a failed casino. So at this point, it's worth asking Mr. Krugman to explain the difference between Revel and a failed casino known as Wall Street. The answer is obvious. When a casino fails in Atlantic City, the creditors get haircuts and content themselves with pennies on the dollar. When the casino known as Wall Street fails, the government makes their debts whole at full face value. If Donald Trump had crammed down Goldman Sachs the way he crammed down the claims of the creditors of the city's failed casinos, the world would be a better place, and the United States of America would have $4 trillion to spend on something other than usury payments to the wealthy. The citizens of this country, in other words, would have more money to spend on products manufactured in places like Indiana.
Amen, brother. Who said that? That was a great piece of writing.
A genius writer.
Who is that guy?
Is Mr. Krugman in favor of bailing out failed casinos known as the failed casino known as Wall Street?
Of course he is.
Because he works for the oligarchs.
Of course he does. Yeah. Of course he does. Guess what? He was called into Iceland. Guess what he advised the Icelandic people to do?
Pay off their debts.
Yeah, that's right. And they said, thanks, Paul. We'll see you later. And they stiffed the bankers.
They said, our debts.
they said, basically, the guy who did it is two blocks down the street. You can ask him for the money. If he doesn't have it, well, then you can wait, you know, until he gets it to you. But we're not paying for it. And the stupid Irish did the exact opposite. And now they are going to be enslaved. They will be condemned to austerity, cutting back their pensions, no infrastructure improvements, because all of that money has to go to pay off the bad debts of some crook that ran the bank.
But Dr. Jones, they're sexually freer than now.
That's right. Guess what? this goes hand in glove. So basically, okay, you guys have been screwed financially, but hey, there's the gay disco.
And
you can dance all your troubles away with your boyfriend at the gay disco and hope that somebody doesn't shoot you.
that's the payoff there, right?
Seriously, what we're seeing here is why sexual liberation is an integral part in the New World Order and the role that it plays to basically distract you from the fact that you're being screwed financially. That's the whole point of this. All of those gay boys down in Orlando, you know, if they weren't in the gay casino, if they hadn't allowed themselves to be consumed by that lifestyle, they would have gone on and gotten married, and they would have had children, and then they'd be thinking, I need a raise. Boss, I need a raise.
And they'd have some concern for posterity.
That's right, and they'd be committed to a system, and they could be they could unite, and they could work, which is basically what we're doing back to the 1930s. Remember when the left actually was interested in real issues like wages? Well, guess what? All they're interested in now is the gay disco.
Yeah, sodomy is the
So that you see the role that sexual liberation plays in keeping everyone under control. I, by the way, there's another article I did on Michel Foucault in the May issue about how the oligarchs got their power. And basically the whole change took place in 1975. What you saw there was a meeting at Chateau Rambouillet in France, and Helmut Schmidt declared the end of Fordism. Fordism meaning industrial infrastructure, high wages, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. Production will now go to China. Now, the other interesting thing that happened in 1975 is Michel Foucault, the philosopher king of France, the successor of Jean-Paul Sartre, made, this is not, this is his term and its biographer's term, sealed a pact with the devil in Death Valley, took LSD in Death Valley and had this epiphany. And basically what the epiphany was, the deal is he betrayed the left. And he said, now you let us screw ourselves to death, which is what he did in the bathhouses of San Francisco, and we won't complain about your economic system. That was the crucial turning point. That is the system that we have today. Mm-hmm. That's, in other words, if you give us the gay disco, and we won't complain about low wages. That's what's going on.
You summed it up well in the piece here on Trump. It goes something like this. Hillary Clinton summed up the zeitgeist in spite of herself when she said, even if we broke up the big banks, we would still have racism and sexism. What she really meant to say was, the oligarchs pay me to distract voters with fears of racism and sexism so they don't threaten to break up the banks of the oligarchs whose money funds my campaign. The same trick.
Yeah.
And that, it gets into the sort of the Black Lives Matter and George Soros and him funding, spending $30 million in Missouri to stir up trouble. And It's what they also, because what the NGOs are doing in the Ukraine and, other areas of the world to stir up trouble. And, Now, in this other piece you wrote on Phyllis Schlafly takes on the oligarchs. How she almost single-handedly, I guess you could say she did, because she was such a masterful organizer, she stopped the this locomotive called ERA coming, it was coming down full steam, and she just stopped it dead on. Yet she herself internalized many of the beliefs and values of her oppressors. Right?
That's right. That's right. I characterize Phyllis Schlafly as the abused wife of the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. Let's cut to the chase. She was the greatest grassroots organizer in America in the 20th century. Nothing compared to what she did in derailing the ERA, and she did it by mobilizing women who would go and lobby these state legislatures all across the country. Well, guess what's under attack right now? It's the state legislatures, because they, in a sense, are amenable to the will of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's precisely the problems. But but the Republicans didn't like that, really. They like it when she tells the ladies to go out and pull the Republican lever. But they don't like the people. Let's face it. And she's masterful in describing the history of the Republican Party, of choosing basically a fall guy who's chosen to lose. Wendell Willkie being the classic example, because all of these Republicans were internationalists. They were all involved in finance. They wanted Roosevelt to win. They wanted America to get in the war, so they nominated a fall guy from Indiana. Nobody ever heard of Wendell Willkie. He was a complete creation of Madison Avenue and Time Life. That simple. And so he took the fall. The same thing happened with who's the Viagra guy? I forgot.
Bob Dole.
Bob Dole, was chosen not to win the election, but to destroy Pat Buchanan and destroy the Buchananite wing of the party, make sure they did not get in, could not be a vote, and so on and so forth. So that's what it is. So based on, I wrote this, I guess I wrote this in February, March, and I said the same thing's going to happen to Donald Trump. What I didn't realize was how powerful the support, the groundswell for behind Trump was, and it got so powerful that the Republicans are just in a quandary. They don't know what to do. They're in a bind. They can win with Trump, or they can lose with, you can't even lose with anybody anymore. All the losers are out of the election. It's just Trump. The turning point came in Indiana when Ted Cruz dropped out. He was the guy at that point. So now what are they going to do? Well, Sheldon Adelson, I think, the casino magnate, gave him $100 million. And I think the catch was he was supposed to appoint Newt Gingrich as vice president. That's one way if you reel these people in, which is what the oligarchs did when Ronald Reagan got the nomination. And they attached George H.W. Bush to him, the CIA guy, mm-hmm. to make sure that he didn't get out of control.
And then a few months later, within 2 months of him being sworn in, someone takes a shot at him.
Yeah. And anytime someone takes a shot at the president, I think the chief suspect is the vice president. I think that's
– Well, the shooter their family were actually business associates and very friendly with the Bushes. And that's not talked about.
No. And you have to know what the schedule is. And so it's got to be somebody close. Well, I mean, they did, this is what happened with John F. Kennedy. I think mm-hmm. Lyndon Johnson was involved in the conspiracy. And then you have a situation like George W. Bush, who was basically run by Dick Cheney. He was the vice president attached to him to make sure that he did the bidding of the oligarchs. Mm-hmm. So I was going to say there's – who knows? I predicted there would be a brokered convention that they would not give the nomination to Trump. But I don't see how that's possible anymore. I just don't see how it's possible. Well, so they'll have to find another way to bring him under control.
Well, the Trump campaign is in trouble because George Will announced he's leaving the Republican Party.
Oh, my God. Did the sun come up the next day? Is this the end of the world as we know it? I mean, who has been listening to George Will? He won the Pulitzer Prize in 1977 and everybody, walked out of the room. Remember when George Will used to talk about was against abortion, talked about his retarded son and all that type of mm-hmm. stuff? Well, now, I mean, the even worse was the Robbie George and George Weigel with that manifesto, that Catholic manifesto in National Review. Trump is not a true conservative. What does that mean? Does that mean other than you're the commissar, Robbie? I mean, you're the guy who tells us what a true conservative is. Give me a break. You're saying is that you're irrelevant to the whole political process.
Well, the National Review is an interesting story because you get Wilmoth Buckley, and Wilmoth Buckley has been called the Pied Piper of the right. And his job was to sort of corral the conservative movement and get rid of the miscreants who actually questioned the Cold War agenda.
Yeah, he was a commissar.
Yeah.
And the proof of it was what he did to Joe Sobern and Pat Buchanan.
Yeah, Joe Sobern. That was in the early 90s. They had the temerity to point out that the Cold War was over. and we don't need all this nonsense.
Yeah, Pat Buchanan in the early 92, 96, he was the Ahmadinejad of his day. The Jews were so upset with Pat Buchanan that they had to yank Buckley's chain, and Buckley denounced him as an anti-Semite. Just an act of complete craven perfidy.
But that's a lot of these. I mean, it's been called National Review, Buckley as sort of CIA conservatism, because of course he worked for the CIA. He worked for E. Howard Hunt in Mexico,
right?
And the seed money for National Review was never accounted for, which, given the history of the Congress of Cultural Freedom and the involvement of the intelligence community in publications,
it came out at exactly the same time that the Congress of Cultural Freedom was funding Encounter and things like that.
They put two and two together. Same time, in a few years they're going to be behind the publication of Ms. Magazine and the development of feminism. So here you have again, you have the dialectic being created. They're covering all sides.
Right.
Getting people to talk about sex, to fight about fight about being men and women. At the same time, they're acquiring or they're accumulating their usurious profits.
That's right. To distract us all from the real issues. That's right. That's exactly the point.
They're doubling the workforce and destroying the family and the communities that these families flourished in. Right?
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. And Indiana is a prime example. Yeah. Indiana is a conquered province.
And one thing is, by reading your work and others, is just with some good research, you realize that much of what unfolded in the second half of the 20th century, post-war America, wasn't market forces. It wasn't the development of society, reacting to economic trends and all that. It was a psychological warfare operation, a mass social engineering scheme concocted back as the late 30s or early 40s, if not before that. But with the destruction of the urban neighborhoods, interstate highway system.
That didn't kick in until after World War II, but it was basically the psychological warfare establishment that staffed all of these operations. Mm-hmm. I have that in my book, The Slaughter of Cities, which is about urban renewal, and the destruction of Catholic neighborhoods, and also in libido dominandi, which is the sexual social engineering that took place during this period of time.
Yeah, one thing I thought was interesting was in your article in Shafley, you mentioned, I guess there was Shafley's biographer mentioned there was a placard at an anti-ERA rally that said, if you like Judge Garrity, you'd love ERA. And they're invoking, you know, the busing issue in Boston.
That's right. That was really the thing. The Catholics had been so brutalized by social engineering that they were ready for what they thought was the antithesis of social engineering, namely the free market, you know. And, of course, that was just worse. It was jumping from the frying pan into the fire.
And this is how the Catholics, of course, were forced into the Republican Party by the changes in the Democratic Party in the 70s with McGovernism. And the,
right.
As Nixon called, was it amnesty, acid, and abortion?
Yeah. 72, the George McGovern campaign. That's right. Where they basically, between 68, the attack on Mayor Daley that took place in Chicago, to 72, the Catholic ethnics were purged from the Democratic Party. And by that point, they had no place to go. 76, they weren't even addressed. And then finally, Reagan got the bright idea. No, that's not true. I mean, Nixon did address these people. He did actively court the disaffected Catholic ethnics.
They were part of the silent majority, I guess.
That's right. Yeah. He did court these people, and they did respond. So that began with Kevin Phillips' book, The Emerging Republican Majority in 68. So that's when it began. And then, of course, the Catholics got betrayed by the Republicans ultimately as well, especially when the Jews took over, the neocons took over the foreign policy, and basically nothing ever happened on abortion, but we got plenty of wars in the Middle East.
This was primarily occurred, I guess, it was after Reagan was elected, correct?
It just increased over this period of time. This is the period of when the Jews took over total cultural hegemony of the United States during this period of time.
I guess they got a hold of control of the grant money. I think it was Chronicles magazine that was cheated out of some grants.
That's right. It was the Bradley Foundation. Yeah. And Chronicles was supposed to get a $250,000 grant. And Richard John Newhouse hijacked the grant with the help of Midge Dechter and Norma Bedard's. And First Things was created as a result of that.
And Chronicles was an old – I mean, I subscribed to it back in the early 90s. I remember reading it. It was completely different. It was, you know, just after the fall of Berlin Wall. It was my first introduction into this stuff because, despite default, I was a mainline Republican conservative. I was Catholic, Republican conservative, like many other Catholics. You identified with Reagan. And I started reading some of the articles in there. Of course, this is the early 90s. And I remember it was the December 1991 issue, the 50th anniversary of Pearl Harbor. They devoted a whole edition to America First.
Right.
Yeah. And
right. That's to their credit. They were on to the neoconservatives before anyone else was.
Yeah.
They exposed what was going on before anyone else did.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, how do you get back to how do you resurrect this, or how do you implement? You can't go back in time, you know. But the other thing is that it's the return of the repressed. There's this thing that just refuses to go away, and now it's reared its ugly head again. I mean, from their Jewish perspective, the ugly head of America First is now coming back again, in spite of all of this massive social engineering and propaganda. It's just not going to go away. It's not going to go away.
Well, yeah, because human nature rears itself, and you can't do away with it.
We understand now the way the system works in a way that we did not understand it 20 years ago.
But you made a very good point in when your interview with Phyllis Schlafly, print the transcript of much of the interview in the article, and you made a very good point here when you talked about her success with ERA. And what's her final conclusion on her life's work? I guess you were successful. She says, yes, I was successful, but you make the point that regardless, despite the fact that ERA was stopped, it's been implemented gradually over the years by the oligarchs.
That's right.
Yeah.
So it didn't matter.
One thing is, one of the big stumbling blocks of ERA was its critics pointed out that because of its broad wording, it could be construed to legalize gay marriage. And this stopped it 40 years ago. Now what's the court imposing on the country now? Gay marriage.
Of course, yeah. Of course.
Without any amendments to the Constitution,
in a sense, there's a minor victory here because the courts had to impose it.
Yeah.
You know, so we know that this is an oligarch imperative, and the people did not go along with it. So give the people of the United States some credit because they did not go along with this.
Well, it gets implemented by judges and bureaucrats. A good example of that would be Title IX of the Civil Rights Act.
Yes.
You know, where they use this arcane law to impose all this radical, feminism in college sports and programs and education. It's just nonsense.
Yeah, and they felt that with the social engineering propaganda machine that they had, they convince anybody of anything. And basically, I suppose if you can convince someone that two homosexuals can get married, well, then you can convince them of anything because that is prima facie preposterous.
Part of the psyop, I think, of the Orlando incident, and of course, I don't exactly sure what happened down there. I'm skeptical, but you have the supposed shooting, whatever, and then you have, the outright promotion of homosexuality by the media,
right?
You know, so the psyop is obvious to any.
Yeah, whether it's it could be blowback. It's probably blowback because of the guy's background. It could be a false flag, but whatever it is, it's clear that their intention by the way they played it after the fact.
Yeah. Now, another thing is you talk about the of course, behind all this is the deindustrialization, the hollowing out of the U.S. economy, which it's been going on for at least 40, 50 years now through various policies of globalism, macroeconomic policy and all this. The records that you're witnessing in Detroit, in Indiana, the Midwest, the Rust Belt, was largely a plan concocted by the Council of Foreign Relations and the Trilaterals Commission.
You take them as representatives of the elite, I agree with you.
So let's go back to America First. America First is this Midwestern grassroots movement opposing the drive towards war that's promoted by the Anglophile Eastern establishment, the organized Jewish community, and the British Empire.
Right.
This has profound effects on the destruction of local, mid-sized, even large, localized businesses that have an interest, local patriotism in the region and the values. This has been gradually destroyed by globalism. The imposition of Walmart. And a lot of this is done through outfits like Bain Capital, who have access to cheap credit, and they undermine local businesses who don't have the benefit of free credit.
Yeah. You know?
And so local businesses can no longer compete. At the same time, when these corporations come in and take over these companies, they deny job opportunities to these areas. They destroy the local economies. This provides fodder for the U.S. military.
That's right.
At the same time, it also – what you're seeing in North Carolina and you saw in Indiana is the corporations that are controlled by the same globalists can also, through centralized control, interlocking directorates, impose a cultural agenda on these regions by threatening them with unemployment.
That's right.
Whereas if the local economies were developed by local concerns, families that run these companies that were decentralized, no such agenda could be advanced, out of Davos or Bilderberg.
Right.
So there is an important sociological, political, not just economic effect to this when you have the centralization of the economy that's largely been done through malfeasance and thievery.
That's right.
It's not economies of scale. It's not efficiency. This is malfeasance and thievery. This is why Walmart. This is why Staples and these large corporations are ascendant.
Yeah, that's right.
That's where the people who defend the market fail in this because this isn't really the market.
No, that's a joke. These people manipulate the market.
Well, how do you have it when you have manipulated interest rates? When you have $27 trillion being printed by the Fed to bail out whoever, and then Bernanke can't tell Congress who he did this for.
Yeah.
Or as you mentioned, the bailing out of Wall Street, which is the biggest ripoff, continuation of one ripoff after another, which really is the true story behind the U.S. economy.
Yeah.
Going back to Hamilton and Robert Morris and,
No, it was there. And I'm saying that the main difference between Shays' Rebellion and Occupy Wall Street is sexual liberation. because it's the most effective form of control, and it completely short circuits the immune system of the country to protect itself from these predatory economic microbes or macrobes or whatever you want to call them, you know, who basically take your brain over and colonize it so that you can't resist. Your immune system goes down.
Well, what's funny is if you even look at what happened in China, how they destroyed China with opium, the British East India Company, and that was done to maximize profits and reverse the payment imbalances.
The balance of trade, because they were losing money on tea.
Yeah.
They needed something to balance the tea payments.
But the idea that these people would destabilize China, then set China up to be the model for the monopolist capitalist system, which is why David Rockefeller has such love for Chairman Mao, right?
Yeah. Well, Milton Friedman did it. Milton Friedman went there and told the Communist Party bosses how to turn their children into oligarchs, billionaire oligarchs. And that's what they did.
Mm-hmm. And that's, of course, that's he. And what school did he come from?
Milton Friedman, Chicago, yeah. University of Chicago.
And who built that university?
The Rockefellers.
Is that just a coincidence, you think?
Do I win a prize here for getting all these questions right? Am I the smartest guy in the class here?
Just there you go. I mean, it's, well, you know, you can follow it. But, the point is, that, and of course, the Rockefellers are also behind the promotion of sexual liberation with Kinsey.
Kinsey and also birth control. All of these are forms of oligarchic control. It's time to wake up, America, and realize that every sexual freedom you have is a form of bondage and a form of economic control. That's what it's there for.
Mm-hmm. And the two go, you beguile or you distract them with nudity on television and pornography, and then that you can have your way with everybody.
That's right. That's the purpose of it. That's the political purpose of all of these things. Mm-hmm.
And so if all you think about is screwing, you will get screwed.
That's right. There's still some justice in the world, isn't there?
Well, you know, God will not be mocked.
That's right. That's another better way of putting it, I think.
Well, Dr. Jones, anything? I mean, we covered the two articles pretty well and showed how they blended. Is there anything else? Any other observations?
No, I think we're in the middle of an uprising against the oligarchs, and now we need to spread this consciousness to as far and wide.
So yeah, I guess hard work, a lot of prayer, maybe something good can come out of this. The fact that we're relegated to the choice between Trump and Hillary Clinton. I'm not a big fan of Trump, but I understand what's behind this, the steam behind this campaign.
Yeah, that's the important part.
I think that's the important part. And like you said, he's a clock that's right twice a day.
Yeah.
So that's what people have to consider, I guess, if they're given to voting. I don't put too much faith in electoral politics, particularly national electoral politics. I think it's at this point it's more of a cultural thing. We have to get back the culture, and that's more of a gradual approach. I think maybe we should borrow from the Fabians. I don't know. So, on that regard. So, well, great. Well, again, your website is culturewars.com, correct?
Yeah.
And you're the editor of Culture Wars. Your latest book is Barren Metal. Struggle.
We have a number of shorter books out now. Jews and Moral Subversion is the most recent. $20. It's a much shorter kind of summary of a lot of the material I've done lately. So a lot of what we've talked about tonight can be found in that book.
And also the two articles, again, you can still get the April issue of Culture Wars.
April and the June issue are available. So
the June issue covers the Trump of the failed casino.
That's right.
So, and I highly recommend the Phyllis Schlafly piece. It's a wonderful analysis of a phenomenon of the 20th century, and it puts everything in perspective, the history, and it's a good antidote to the fake history we've been given. So, my compliments to you, Dr. Jones, for writing it. So, okay, well, listen, thanks for coming on. And I'll wish you a good night.